This is URN Sport.
Welcome to the Tuesday Sports Show.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for listening to the URN Sport on this Tuesday evening. We will be discussing over the next hour all the sports news from the past week and previewing what's to come over the next 7 days.
Murray wins! Murray wins it all! This is going to be a top play. Why? Because we've got a series! Barrett control this, and the cup is his. He's coming out.
This is URN Sport.
Hello and welcome to this Tuesday Sports Show here on URN. We're going to be bringing you over the next hour all the latest news from around the world of sport, except of course any football news, because we saved that for the weekend. I'm joined here in the studio with Matt, Alex, James and David. So guys, we're going to start things off with a bit of a chat on everything that's been going on with the Ashes. And Matt, you've been keeping a keen eye on what's been going on down under. And unfortunately, it has to be said, the first test didn't exactly go the way of England.
That's right, Jeremy. England ended up losing by 10 wickets, which is a real shame. But in the first 3 days, we were highly competitive. The match was on real tenterhooks at the end of day three. So England batted first and scored 302 all out. Australia then scored 328 all out. And England went at 196 all out. And Australia won by 10 wickets, scoring 175 runs with no wickets in the second innings. So it was an encouraging first couple of days from England, with some new additions to the team in James Vince, Mark Stoneman and David Malan making contributions with the bat. In terms of the bowling, it was a bit more of the old stallions in terms of Anderson and Broad really showing the way to do it in Australia. Wokes struggled a bit, which was a shame, after he had a strong performance in the warm-up match. And Nottinghamshire's Jake Ball was sadly unimpressive, returning one wicket for having about 180 odd runs in the match. So his place might be in doubt for the second match. As I said, it was a close game for the first three days. It was on a knife edge, and Australia just ran away with it after that, doing what Australia do in Ashes series and winning the key moments. The most important difference moving forward for England is quite simply how to get Steve Smith out. He scored 140 odd of their runs in the first innings out of 328. So you take him out of the equation, Australia all out for 160, England 140 runs ahead. So that's a huge difference in the two teams. And quite simply, they didn't do the basics. They didn't bowl straight. They kept on bowling wide outside your stump to try and bowl him out. And this is a man who's the best batsman in the world for the last 3 years, and he has immense concentration. Quite simply, when you're not bowling straight, you're taking two of the key dismissals out in bold and LBW. It's much better to tie him down for bowling straight and make him play the ball. But if he's having to play the ball, he's much more likely to get a nick, to get bowled, or to be LBW than if he's able to leave a lot outside the off stump and then occasionally hit the short one for four.
So there we are, that's Matt's thoughts then on how the first test down under has gone. Bad news, it has to be said, for England. Despite a promising start, the late collapse, it does seem, has cost us that advantage. Now, guys, throwing this open to the rest of you here in the studio for your thoughts on this. I mean, the interesting point about the Bairstow incident has then led on to repercussions of another incident, of course, that occurred before this test that has led to, of course, Stokes not being taken. And his loss, I think, has now suddenly started to be felt. How big... I mean, we talked a lot before the Ashes started that some of us thought this was going to be very impactful. Some of us thought that England would be OK. I mean, quite interesting, I think, before the test actually got underway, a lot of us were saying this was probably going to be one of the tightest four Ashes series for quite a long time, especially considering that usually we do see one of the two teams tends to dominate, but not in this case. It's been very finely poised. With Stokes not being taken down under, do we think then that England are going to be looking back at this as a big mistake, or was it something that we just had to put the foot down for discipline-wise?
I mean, I think you really got to punish. I mean, it's not just drinking or doing the kind of famous pedlo incident for or Flintoff. So I think we really got to understand it was grievous body harm, so you can't just take him along. I mean, sport, we want to win the Ashes, but we've got to have the kind of imposing kind of ethics and moral for our team, more kind of code for our team. So yeah, I do think it's the right decision. I mean, he's currently in New Zealand, I believe, playing, he's always going to be playing some club level cricket. So if a decision does get made, or the police decide to not prosecute Ben Stokes, there is a chance he can come straight back into the side. So I think we've really got to wait for the police investigation to finish before we even consider bringing Ben Stokes back into the fold, because at the moment there's an equal chance of him going to prison as there is him coming back into the Ashes side.
With regards to Stokes, that first innings performance in particular kind of shows that England's problems aren't necessarily just with the batting, and even then, it's a little bit over. I think we're overhyping it a little bit if we call them problems. England were a little unlucky in the way some things went, but in the fact that they're not experienced means that they can't overcome these lack of luck. Almost, it was, you know, the lower order collapses are avoidable, but they're things that happen quite regularly. The width of the line changing depending on how far down the stumps you go is among the more bizarre things to see on a sporting on a sports pitch. But it's more the case that England's performance was promising, given that very few people gave them a chance at a ground that Australia haven't lost at since goodness knows how long. I think it's 1988 the last time they lost an international test match at the Gabba. So to see England put on a decent performance for 3.5 days of a 5-day test, the scoreline doesn't really reflect how well England did, and they'll be confident with the conditions in the day-night test, and if they actually put the right bowlers on at the tail of the Australian innings, for example, that they'll be confident that they can do something with it.
One criticism, though, I would have, kind of the off-the-field antics. I saw a comment from Trevor Bayliss, who's in charge of the England setup, saying that, kind of criticising English players' conduct whilst out in Australia, like kind of what they get up to when they're not training and what have you, said that we need to improve that. That should be a given for a series of kind of this magnitude. Players should be responsible. I saw something about curfews and about not drinking after training. That should be a given. The players, you know, they've got such a huge responsibility on their shoulders, representing their country in a huge tournament against one of, if not the best team in the world in Australia. So I think that's one thing that Bayliss needs to sort out almost as much as what's going on the pitch, because there are positives, as David's just alluded to. If you improve the antics off the field, then England surely will have more of a chance of being successful in this series.
Now we're going to turn our attention to all things rugby. I'm going to start off with rugby union, because it's been a busy week for the home nations. They've been in the middle of their autumn international season that's been going on, and the game that has certainly stood out as a particularly one which I'm sure if you're a rugby fan it's been difficult to stay away from has been Scotland's magnificent victory for them against Australia. Scotland were able to win 53-24. Now, David, this is an incredible victory for Scotland, and a lot of people have suddenly now hailed this as a brand new era for Scottish rugby. If not, some have even tipped them, I believe Jeremy Gus is one of them, as favourites for the Six Nations. Is that potentially basing all this on one result, or have they been looking pretty promising, do you think?
Well, they were very impressive in their game against Australia. Yes, admittedly, the scoreline was helped massively by Australia going down to 14 men, but that is not to take away from the phenomenal attacking power of that Scottish side. Just running in, managing to run in 8 tries against a team as strong as Australia, even as strong as Australia with 14 men, is no mean feat in the slightest. And you are right that some pundits are tipping them for a decent performance in the Six Nations, which would be nice for once. But certainly true to say that their performance in that game came really, really after halftime, after that red card, which was for a high shoulder challenge and an unfair challenge there, and it was quite a nasty one. I seem to remember wincing quite a lot at that. But they had to fight for this. They had to show some heart and they had to show some talent. And definitely true that they managed to show all of that, and very promising signs if you are a Scottish rugby fan. Very promising signs if you're a rugby fan, in truth, as it's going to make for some fantastic rugby in the coming months.
Absolutely. I mean, Scotland have been so impressive in the last year or two. They've really turned themselves around. Yes, they were helped a lot by the red card, but I still think they would have won the match. I think it would have been a tighter scoreline, but I think they are up there, as I would say, potentially. I don't think they'll win the Six Nations. I still think England are the best team by a reasonable distance, but I would definitely say they're in the mix of second and third. Wales looking a distinct fourth now in comparison to Scotland and Ireland. And Stuart Hogg has spoken about how they want to continue this performance, that beating teams like Australia should be a norm. Yes, Australia have been in decline the last couple of years. They've lost some key players, and they're not quite the team that they were perhaps 5-10 years ago. But they're still a very good team, and to beat them so convincingly, even with 14 men, is a fantastic achievement for Scotland, and hopefully they can build on it for the future.
Yeah, I think the Six Nations, as much as anything, needs Scotland to be successful, because it's become a bit of a boring tournament recently. It's more who's going to, I mean, England's going to win it, who may come second. I mean, now there's genuine competition for England. If they can beat Australia, given fact, I mean, they might have had a red card, they might not be as good as they once were, but it's still a thumping win nonetheless. And that kind of shows that who can win the Six Nations now. I mean, it's going to just add a bit more extra oomph to it, and I think that will kind of be only good for the competition as a whole, which has really been in decline the last couple of years.
I think as well, what you've got to look at is Scotland performed brilliantly the week before as well against New Zealand, so this isn't necessarily a one-off. They seem to be riding on a real wave of momentum, and with a player like Stuart Hogg at fullback, he's got the X factor. He's world-class, I would say. So the 14 other men around him, they just seem to have rallied together. There's a good team spirit within that dressing room, clearly. And, you know, I think the sky's the limit for this Scottish team, and like Alex was talking about, the kind of the Six Nations is going to be very competitive when it comes around in 2018, that's
yeah,
for sure.
And talking about Hogg, I mean, he said last week that Scotland should be kind of classed as world class, and I mean, and wins like this are what they're going to have to do to prove that. I mean, obviously they need to now perform in the big tournaments like the World Cup in 2019 and the Six Nations, but I think they've really got to start taking on the big boys. I think they'll hopefully have a game against New Zealand at some point. They'll want to take on England. They, with a team riding this high on confidence, they've got a good manager who performed really well at club level as well. I think they'll really be up for kind of proving themselves against the big boys rather than just kind of like trying to do okay against these teams.
I'm going to make a bit of a rogue shout here in true Euro fashion. I think Scotland are an outside, a dark horse for the 2019 World Cup, the way they're building at the moment. Mm-hmm. Look at the form that they're gradually building up, especially if you've seen that perhaps England might have peaked a bit too soon, and if perhaps New Zealand also on the decline, a couple of their players might be going out by then. Obviously Scotland put New Zealand close a couple of weeks ago, so you never know. Scots, the 2019 World Cup in Japan could be coming your way.
We're going to keep with rugby, but move over to the other discipline, that is of course rugby league, because the World Cup is still going on. It's been going on for quite a while, but we've been keeping you up to date and fully in the loop of everything that's been going on. Now, we're going to obviously cover the game which I think we're all keeping a close eye on, which is of course the fantastic work that England have been doing, because they are through into the Rugby League World Cup final thanks to their 2018 win over Tonga. Now James, when we were talking about this, Jack last week when we were speaking of this, he said that Tonga are a side that England should not underestimate. They are a side which are very tough, and they are a side that do love this game. And the way they fought back at the end and gave England a bit of a scare, it has to be said, at the end, that was certainly the case, wasn't it?
It was incredible comeback, really. So the game itself, England raced into a 20-0 lead. Tries from Jermaine McGilvery, Gareth Widdop, who I thought was the star man at fullback, and John Bateman. And it seemed that going into the last 10-15 minutes or so, England were cruising. But Tonga scored three tries in the space of 7 minutes. And the crowd that was full of Tongans, the atmosphere was incredible. It seemed like the tide was turning quite rapidly in Tonga's direction. And that's been a problem for England in recent years. Once their opposition is in the ascendancy and has momentum behind them, they've really struggled to counter that, and that appeared to be the case. And Tonga, right towards the end of the game, there was a break by David Fifita, and as he was about to cross over the line, Elliot Whitehead, who had a good game in the second row to be honest, tackled Fifita. The ball came loose, Fifita picked it back up and crossed over the line. The referee, Matt Chechen, the Australian, he ruled that it was a knock on, it was a loose carry, and he didn't refer to the video referee, which was a stunning decision, really, because and showed real confidence in his convictions. When the replay that I've seen back, I would have awarded the try. It looks like a ball steal from Elliot Whitehead. Fifita has every right to then go and pick the ball up and cross the line. So England were fortunate in that regard, but they're through to the final. They haven't been fantastic in the tournament. Wayne Bennett himself came out after the game and said he doesn't expect England to win on Saturday, which is I'm sure will fill the squad with lots of confidence. But they've managed to get there against real adversity in those last 10 minutes, like we're saying, against Tonga. And on Saturday, who knows what will happen, because Australia are definitely the clear favourites. They've kind of waltzed through this tournament, really. But England have shown real togetherness and commitment throughout, particularly in the quarterfinals and semi-finals. So who knows what the full-time result will be on Saturday.
I think, you know, England haven't played particularly well in the tournament as a whole. I thought one of the highlights of the tournament, you know, as a loss, was our performance against Australia. I mean, I can't remember what the exact score was. It
13-4.
Okay, not quite as close as I thought it was, but I still remember us taking some heart from our performance against Australia. And I think, yeah, we did lose, and by the sounds it was more convincing than I thought, but we can beat them if we perform. And obviously, maybe Australia have a bit of an off day, so we kind of got to take a bit of heart for that, but I don't hold up too much hope. I'm not sure if James does.
Well, there was the last time we've tasted success against Australia was when it was Great Britain in 2006. Similar circumstances, really. Great Britain went over. Nobody was confident of a victory. The Australian press, like they have been doing throughout this tournament, have been writing off England, criticising the head coach, Wayne Bennett, and Great Britain pulled off one of the most incredible victories that international National Rugby League has ever seen. So hopefully England can do something similar on Saturday. My head says it's going to be a close one, but Australia will just have the quality to get through. I think the way to sum up their performance throughout the tournament is efficient. They haven't played the sparkling rugby that you'd necessarily associate with them over the years. They've kind of been ruthless when they've been 20 metres away from the try line, and the defence is as good as anyone's. But I think England, if they can knuckle down in the week, if Wayne Bennett can get the best out of Gareth Woodup again, who put in one of the best performances I've seen from a fullback in recent times against Tonga, then hopefully, fingers crossed, England can come home with the trophy on Saturday night.
Should England, though, have been sort of more cautious potentially of Tonga, because obviously Tonga in the previous game where they beat New Zealand, they came back from being behind in that. It was 16-2 before they started their counter-attack. Surely, I mean, you touched on there, James, saying how England this tournament, they haven't really been able to hold on to that lead with much confidence. Surely that, coupled with what Tonga had done previously, they should have been more aware of it, because by the sounds of it, Tonga really got into their momentum towards the end of the match, and if it had gone on a bit longer, we might have been looking at England being knocked out again.
Definitely. The only thing I would say is that when you're 20 points to nil up in rugby league, especially with 10 minutes to go, that's three converted tries plus a penalty. So you're pretty much home and hosed at that point in the game. But obviously, the crowd were fantastic. 25,000 sellout, and the Tonga fans were really driving their team on. That's one thing that you have to say about the Pacific Island teams in the tournament, Fiji, Samoa and Tonga. Even if the game has been going out of their reach, for example, Fiji in the semi-final against Australia lost 54-6, they keep fighting until the end. Tonga, they have that spirit, but they also have that quality within their team. A lot of NRL players, that's the league in Australia, a couple of Super League representatives as well. So England will have to be a lot tighter when it comes to the game on Saturday, because that last 10 minutes or so they were very loose. Tonga were making breaks from all over the field, and it's just about stopping that wave of momentum that the opposition has. And if England can do that, then hopefully they can get a positive result on Saturday.
Hi, I'm Alison Mitchell from the BBC's Test Match Special. You're listening to URN Sport.
So we're going to be running now over our final topic here on today's show, and well, I suppose we haven't covered it for a bit. We're going to throw things back. When we throw to athletics, it always seems to be a story about Russian athletics and doping seems to pop up, and that's happened again today, hasn't it, Alex? Because we've seen that the Russian athletes are going to remain suspended according to the IAAF, which will mean, we believe, when we were discussing earlier, it's things like, for example, the Diamond League and the World Championships they're going to be kept out of. Not at the moment, from what we could gather, the Olympics, but it's a bit uncertain.
Actually, the Winter Olympics, I think they're getting their decision on that in December. So there is, it's not just the, I was going to say minor, but the kind of tournaments that don't get kind of global recognition, maybe from like, or get media fanfare, but are still big for the athletes. So it is quite bad, quite a lot of bad news for Russia. They were expecting to hear better news. I mean, WADA did say if they made progress by this time since their kind of ban back in 2015, they would be allowed to be, they would be readmitted. But suppose they have not made sufficient progress on the whole. They haven't set up RUSDA, which would be their Russian form of kind of WADA. and they haven't really kind of made enough steps in the eyes of the IAAF to kind of warrant getting rid of this kind of blanket ban.
Yeah, it is very surprising. I mean, obviously, it's, like you said, 2 years since the ban was initially imposed, and with the review having gone the wrong way for the Russians, considering that they made a public apology about this, do we think that it was very much window dressing that they were doing with these whole sort of apologies and sorry for when, if, according to the IAAF, I might put an extra A in there, I think, but if, according to them, that they feel that Russia hasn't taken adequate steps, what do we think then is the situation? Aren't we thinking that Russia fundamentally then disagrees with the decision? I mean, obviously they will disagree with the decision because it's been detrimental to them, but do we think that they are of such adherence to it that they aren't actually making any steps to it?
I think they will make steps towards it because they want to compete in these competitions. I mean, someone has said that these kind of sports are kind of war without kind of weapons, and it is a kind of geopolitical kind of implications behind it. These countries want to prove that they are the best in their sports, and that's kind of part of the reason why there's kind of doping involved. And I do think they might want to make steps towards it, but truthfully, I think at this stage, the countries, I don't think Russia are the only country to do it at all, but I think it'd be potentially Russia looking at other ways to avoid getting caught again, truthfully, and that might be part of the reason that they are taking this time. They might want to appear on the outside that they're adhering to these rules, but I really don't think that many countries are really kind of adhering to WADA's regulations.
I think you've hit the nail on the head. There is a difference between state-sponsored doping, there's a difference between the charges that have been levelled at Russia and following WADA's regulations. RUSADA, the Russian anti-doping agency, have complied with pretty much everything the IAAF have asked of them. And that the charges are still on is, and it's quite clear to see with the evidence that there is, nothing more than political showboating. That WADA have this power and being this sort of body, that they've said, yeah, you know what, we can keep this ban on, we're going to keep the ban on. RUSADA have complied with pretty much everything that was asked of them, and by pretty much, I mean, the only things that weren't complied with was the requests for evidence, which was already claimed by WADA that they couldn't find enough of it. So if WADA can't find enough of it, what are they expecting RUSADA to do? Oh yeah, no, it's all right, we found some more evidence down the back of the sofa. Or, I don't know, down the back of the balalaika or whatever it is. So I think really that these sorts of the charges are a little bit pathetic because they genuinely hinder athletes who have done nothing wrong merely because an organisation is deemed to have done something wrong. And it is unfair that there's a blanket ban. I understand why, if a sport isn't sure, they should have a ban on it, as the Olympics have suggested doing. But the Winter Olympics banning them completely and the IAAF refusing to lift their ban, it is, in the truest sense of the word, draconic.
And I think, in my opinion, it's not going to work. I mean, I don't think every athlete should kind of face these sanctions because they might be innocent. And I don't think banning a whole nation is going to work because, as I said earlier, I think Russia, given this, will look for other ways to get around it. I think the way to tackle it is to put tougher sanctions on individuals to do it. I say personally ban for life. I don't think you should get a second chance. And also, you've got to find new ways to kind of crack down on doping itself. I mean, you've got to make it harder for these people who want to dope and make it look for any kind of investment into getting them caught, so it makes it harder and raises the cost of doping.
I think it's such double standards to not ban people like Justin Gatlin for life and then allow Russia and then ban the whole of Russia. I don't think you need a country ban. I think that there's a lot of individual athletes who have been convicted of doping. They've been shown clearly to have committed these crimes and been given a 3-year ban or whatever, and it's just completely wrong and unfair on all these athletes who are clean.
Yeah, absolutely, and it's hard to justify. You guys have, you know, you're not taking a country's side in this. It is merely absurd that a country that is going to commit this sort of thing, and cycling is the easiest example of this. I'm aware it's not in the Winter Olympics, obviously, but it's a sport where the use of therapeutic these TUIs, these therapeutic use or TUEs, therapeutic use exemptions, is so overblown. We've had the British riders involved in it recently.
Yeah, there's these been allegations scandals. For Sky, I believe. Yeah. Sky have been dragged
through Wiggins.
Wiggins and Froome have both suffered in this recently.
And that's what I think it's a global thing. I mean, I do think it's not only state-sponsored in Russia. I mean, there are allegations against China in the Beijing Olympics, but I do think every country does it because most athletes think, I've got to do it. Everyone does it now, so I have to do it in order to compete. And that's what I mean. I think they should focus more on stopping doping by making it harder to dope and more tests, and that's the only way they'll get rid of it.
This is URN Sport.